720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. Big show planned for you, lots to do. We're going to, of course, be talking a little bit about Super Bowl ads, what we can expect, some themes we can see emerge, things like that, but plenty of other things, including we're going to take an in-depth look at the data surrounding the January jobs report that has just been released. But to start things off, we are joined by Mary Wisniewski, transportation reporter at Chicago Tribune, who wrote about how ride sharing has quadrupled in the last 3 years in Chicago and traffic congestion that comes with it, particularly concerns around infrastructure and room and space and all of those things. Mary, thanks so much for being with us. Welcome to the program.
Okay, thank you.
So talk with us about this, because it's I think it's one of those things we all have seen anecdotally. We've all noticed it. We've seen lots of, you know, Lyft drivers with their different color, you know, dashboard lights and all that. And it does seem like it is a bit more crowded. And so what is the city, where is the city's mind on this in terms of how to address it?
Right now what they're saying is that they encourage competition, that they want people to have choices. But I was curious about what the numbers were, because I keep hearing anecdotally from cab drivers and others that the streets are more congested with rideshare vehicles. So we've seen this enormous explosion. It was 15,000 vehicles are driving four or more times a month back in March of 2015, and now it's up to almost 70,000 in December of 2017. So you can see this enormous surge on the streets. We don't know exactly by data how much new rideshare how much congestion there is, because we don't have the vehicle counts from everywhere. But you can kind of see it out there. And what people are telling me is that with the mix of construction and with the mix of bike lanes and the mix of rideshare vehicles, that they just can't get around the loop as fast as they used to. And it's actually cutting into their money, both for cab drivers and for rideshare vehicle operators, because they if you can't get around as fast, you can't pick up as many fares.
Right, indeed. But yet, as you note in the piece that you wrote at ChicagoTribune.com, city officials are noting a decrease of garage revenues. So
right.
While there may be more drivers out given rideshare and that sort of thing, there are plenty of people, myself included, who are carless because of how many options, including public transportation, are out there.
Right. Right, it's a mixture. On one hand, you might be seeing more congestion. On the other hand, it's giving people choices that maybe they don't have to take their car downtown. And the other thing that I noted in the story is that there has been a study by the Shared Use Mobility Center that a lot of the rideshare use is being used on evenings and weekends when people may be drinking, or they may not, want to use public transportation because they feel uncomfortable using it at night. And so rideshare gives them that other option. But I think it's really important to look at these figures, because we want to, we care about what our city looks like and what our streets look like. And we have to, and there's also some resentment from cab drivers that, that the rideshare vehicles aren't held to the same rules and the same limitations that they are.
Right. I think there is a lot of that, a bit of a contentious relationship between rideshare drivers and cab drivers, but also with some officials. And in the story, you spoke with an alderman who had really, really not necessarily been in big support of rideshare and really wanted more regulation and a bit more restriction around it.
Right. Anthony Beal has tried to create more restrictions for rideshare. He's tried to hold them to the same rules that taxi drivers have, and being fingerprinted and going through the same regular tests, and he has found it very difficult to get these some extra regulations passed.
And then what is the impact on public transportation? As we see, as you note, we see more rideshare happening nights and weekends when people maybe are not comfortable taking public transportation late at night, something like that. Is there data that's supporting that idea that also perhaps public transportation is going down?
Yes, we are. We've seen a 9% decrease in the number of people riding public transportation between 2012 and 2016, especially on buses. And this is not just in Chicago. This is happening around the country, and other cities, too, have been trying to find out what the impact of rideshare is and how it's impacting public transportation. One thing Chicago has done that is different is that it's imposed an extra rideshare fee just to help public transportation, and it was the first city to do that in recognition that there might be this connection.
And so as you were working on this story and doing this reporting, was there anything that really surprised you or stuck out as just a really unexpected detail that perhaps, you know, a reader might have missed or maybe didn't make the story?
Well, one of the things that surprised me was how difficult it was to get this information. I first sought this information from the city back in the summer of last year and really had to wrangle with them to get the numbers. They didn't give me everything that I asked for. And a lot of it was because there was concerns about sharing proprietary information from the rideshare companies, from Uber and Lyft and Via. And so that was a surprise. I really didn't think that this would be that difficult, and it turned out to be. And so we were really glad to be able to get the numbers that we have so we can start looking at this problem in a more systematic way.
Yeah, for sure. Well, if you follow me on Twitter, I will be sure and tweet this story out after the broadcast so that everybody can read it. There's a lot of really interesting information in here. So Mary Wisniewski, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking with Stephen Esposito, Senior Vice President and Wealth Advisor with Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest. We're going to be taking a look at the January jobs report and really diving into those numbers and that data and taking a look at what it all means. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. We are joined now by our friend Stephen Esposito. You regular listeners, you have definitely heard him on before. He is the guy we bring in when we have a big old bunch of data around the economy and we need to make a little bit of sense of it. So he is with us. He is Senior Vice President and Wealth Advisor with Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So the January jobs report, it is out. It is a thing. There's a lot of people wrestling with it and trying to interpret it and think about it. Help us make sense.
It's good. The numbers are good. 200,000
okay,
jobs.
Go to break.
Anytime you create more jobs, it's good. So it's very positive.
Yeah. I mean,
the entire direction and trajectory of the jobs market and the economy right now is fantastic, and I would enjoy it while we've got it, because it should hopefully last for a while.
And, you know, a lot of times, and I feel like we anytime there's a big economic number that comes out, it seems like we have a conversation about reaction, because a lot of people want to do something with that or do something about it right away.
Yeah, that's correct. I wouldn't do that. Don't be a, we call a headline investor. That's kind of silly. Look at the overall trend. Look what your situation is. Don't change. You know, if you got a plan, you can tweak it, but you're right. Don't react to every little bit of news out there. There's more traders and algorithmic and computer trading that causes the volatility. It's not really individual investors calling us up and saying the jobs numbers was 2,000 off, so we should sell everything. Just stay focused.
Yeah. Keep with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Make your plan and keep with it. I feel like that's a theme that you echo a lot. And so talk to me a bit about how the markets reacted to that, because we did see some reaction there. And how should people be thinking about that and approaching that?
Unfortunately, many in the news media say whatever happened that day, that must be the reason for why it happened. And I don't believe that was the reason. The numbers are good. The market's been on a tear for 13 months. We haven't had a correction whatsoever in 13 months. We got ahead of ourselves. As I tell people, even in a beautiful climate, you're going to get some rain once in a while. Don't view it as a negative. View it as an opportunity potentially to get into the market if you're not in, or deploy more capital. But don't run out and panic. This correction doesn't worry me at all. I'm not afraid of it. I'm looking at where the economy's going, the GDP growth numbers. Yes, interest rates have gone up and they're going up. But when you look at a 10-year treasury at 2.85 as opposed to 2.75 a few days earlier, do you really believe investors sold off because rates went up a tenth of a percentage point? Yeah, it's just they're trying to fill in the blank why it happened. It's normal. It's a normal correction. I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, it seems just last week, in fact, we were talking on the show about the change in leadership at the Federal Reserve and how we often, you know, are so much looking at numbers that we know these things are influenced by human things and emotional things, and we know it, but yet we have this tendency when there is a big data point out to completely forget the human part and the emotional part. And sometimes I think that leads us to react.
Oh, absolutely. You've got to try to be cold. I mean, I have to say that, but it's difficult to not be emotional, especially when news is coming at you 24/7 from every device you've ever seen, and everybody's got an opinion, and
right.
Everybody tries to figure that out. Just, you know, can't see the forest for the trees. The news has been good. And that's what you have to focus on. Also, the reports that come out, you have to remember, they're not precise. These numbers always revised upward or downward later. So this reaction to a specific number on a given day is ridiculous. Because next month, they'll say, well, that number wasn't real. We're actually 20,000 jobs more or 20,000 jobs less. So why react? So No, I agree.
I mean, that is an important footnote, though, that often these big chunks of data, these big swaths of information, they are corrected later, or there'll be a lot of different organizations will interpret them differently, and everybody seems to have a different stake in them. So everybody chill.
That's a great way, right? New financial term, chill.
Just chill. Chill. See, I could be a financial advisor.
Absolutely. We'll hire you. Just tell me when.
Just be like, here, you just need to chill.
Right.
That'd be good. All right. There's a career move for me. There's an option. Oh, okay. So let's talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve, just because I think when we're looking at the economy, that's such an important piece. And we do have this leadership change. You know, that part aside, I know that's kind of embroiled in some political stuff, but that part aside, given the person coming in to replace Janet Yellen, who has pretty much seemed to kind of go along with her agenda and kind of have her back on a lot of topics. Do you foresee do you think that we're going to see many changes or much happening there?
I don't think so. I think you have a little bit more hawkish in terms of this new Fed governor going forward, as far as the makeup of the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. But I don't see rates skyrocketing suddenly. Today's generation hasn't seen high interest rates. Back in the 70s and 80s, you saw interest rates are 15-18%. So when people see 3% now, they panic because it might go to 4% or mortgage rates. I remember locking in a 12% mortgage rate years ago. So don't overreact. You have to look at the raw number and say that, well, the Fed raised interest rates. Yeah, rates have been low for 7 years. It's about time we started to ratchet up a little. But they're going to do it in a measured pace. They're not going to get, you know, all militaristic on it. They're not going to do that. It's going to be fine. They'll do it slowly. There's an argument on both sides. You should be faster or slower. But I think they'll do it at a measured pace, and I wouldn't worry about it. It's all based on data. If the data gets better, it allows them to raise rates. Mm-hmm. The big thing is look at the long term. The long term rates have been held down because of central banks buying bonds, mm-hmm. artificial buying. As they start to unwind that, the longer rate will start to do better and have a more steep yield curve, which is what you have to look for.
Yeah. And then talk to me a bit about wage growth. I know that's such a big component here, too. And it's that's kind of a Pandora's box. You open that one, there's so much to it and there's a lot of conversation there. But generally speaking, when we're looking at data around wage growth, what are the things we need to be mindful of that perhaps aren't the things we normally hear about or pointed to?
Well, of course, the positives of wage growth, there's more money in the economy. People are doing better. Unemployment is dropping across all levels. And that's a positive. It's more money into the economy of the velocity factor. That's all good. The negative is that means costs may go up going forward. But I don't really see – I personally don't see that happening in such a way, because technology displaces a lot of that, unfortunately, in some jobs. And technology makes us more productive. So I think as the pie gets bigger, it's a good thing. I don't see rampant inflation. I've been hearing about rampant inflation for 30 years. We were supposed to get it back in 2011, remember, because the Fed was loosening and printing money. It never happened. Gold went to $1,900. Now gold's $1,200. So I don't see it happening because you have the ability to buy anything all over the world cheaper. So I think it's a real positive for America's workers, and actually all over the world, wages are going up. I think it's good. It's about time they got a bigger piece of the pie, and it's starting to happen. And their 401ks are doing well.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned technology, so I'm curious mm-hmm. about that, because I think technology has changed every industry in so many interesting ways, and I have to think it has done so in your industry very interestingly, both for people doing the work you do as well as for the investor.
That's a much different world. And I started in this business 35 years ago, dramatically different. I mean, there's only 5 mutual funds in existence in 1983. Today, there are 13,000 mutual funds. There's information, and it's good. It gives people a lot of data. However, there's a lot of bad information. Just because it's on the internet, folks, that doesn't mean it's real.
And if it's in Comic Sans, it's definitely not real.
Exactly. Be very careful. I think there's a bigger negative. There's too much information. People react, as you pointed out, mm-hmm. in headlines too quickly because they can trade off their phone now.
Right.
It's created more volatility. Technology within our industry with algorithmic trading has created more volatility. So, yeah, I think it's a more difficult environment. It's not as simple as it used to be with just simply investing and not worrying about it. Just don't get a quote on your phone every 10 minutes and make decisions based on that.
I think that would drive me crazy.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, I think it's really interesting to look at the role that social media plays, because everybody is connected to some expert, non-expert on social media, right? That you're like, well, that seems like a smart person, and they're saying this. Even if you don't believe them necessarily, they've put a thought in your head about something, about politics, about money, about something. And I think that's really interesting to consider that and you know, the financial impact.
Well, they do on whether it be Facebook or whatever. They'll get on there and say, oh, the market's crashing. Remember Brexit?
Yeah.
Brexit was going to cause the world to come to an end.
Sure.
And the market's thousands and thousands of points higher. the panic on the social media today. Everybody's saying, well, I talked to some people and my friends. Is all right. Sometimes too many opinions is a bad thing. It really is. Try to find one or two people that are consistent. Look at their track record of recommending things to you and what they said in the past, whether it be shows like this, and then follow and say, well, you know, they were right the last four times or wrong the last three, and try to go with that. But don't use Facebook to make investment decisions.
Don't base your retirement on some dude on Twitter.
Because you may never retire.
you may never ever retire. Indeed. And so that brings us back to the soundest financial advice. Just chill.
Right. I think that's a t-shirt we should start. We'll talk to Morgan Stanley. It's probably our new logo, chill.
I like it. Sounds good. I'm on board with that. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Stephen Esposito, Senior Vice President and Wealth Advisor with Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. So, coming up a little bit later, we're going to be talking about Super Bowl ads, what we can expect to see tomorrow during the big game, because that's always a big topic of conversation every year this time. But right now, we are joined by Drake Bennett, staff writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote about GE, a company once known for its management tactics. Well, there's been some changes there. Things are not looking as strong as perhaps they used to look with management, and how exactly that happened. The headline on this story, which if you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this out after the program. The headline on this story is how GE went from American icon to astonishing mess, which is a bold headline and one that really catches you right away. Drake, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
All right. So talk us through all this for those who perhaps have not been following the latest with this company. We think of this really, as you say, American iconic brand, but now really embroiled with so much other stuff. So what is the latest with this and where did it begin?
Well, it kind of depends on how narrowly you want to focus. I mean, the most immediate cause for the crisis at GE was a misreading of the gas turbine market. The turbines that go in natural gas power plants are a big business for GE. And last year they really misread the market, ended up with making a lot more of these than they should have, and it cost them, you know, billions of dollars. Now, GE is actually a big enough company that, you know, you can lose a few billion dollars and it's not the end of the world. But the problem is the way in which this happened and the way in which this was disclosed really exacerbated these existing fears that investors and people outside the company had started to have about how well it's run and how transparent they are about information about the company, and fundamentally whether it still makes sense for there to be this giant company called GE that's in all these different businesses.
Right. And what was the first spark of that when people began to question and really some deeper look seemed warranted? What was the first indication of that?
I think you can go back to the end of Jack Welch's tenure at GE. Welch obviously was this much lionized CEO and leader and guru of all things management. But you can really see even at the, you know, before he stepped down in 2001 that a lot of GE's earnings were coming from the growth in this in GE Capital, its financial services arm. And this was a way for them to be more than just a stodgy manufacturing company, but to be in this high growth financial services sector. And also it allowed them to do some slightly creative things with their earnings that really at the time pleased investors, and which is why you saw the stock price climb and climb and climb. But the shortcomings of that approach started to be clear, you know, basically immediately after Welch stepped down. And then they became glaringly obvious in the financial crisis when GE almost went out of business because they ended up being very much exposed to the freeze in the credit markets, which I think shocked a lot of people because GE was supposed to be this company that made jet engines and light bulbs and these real things that you could sell that wasn't dependent on these, you know, exotic financial instruments. So I think a lot of the fear that people were left with after the financial crisis, when right up until you know, right up until things went really badly, GE's leadership was telling everyone that things were fine. That's kind of what you see happening again now, where as some bad news comes out, people start to worry, what else is in there? Do they really know what they're doing? Do all these businesses make sense together? And so a lot of these things, GE's bigness and interconnectedness and all the thing that used to be seen as the way this company could survive these dips in various markets, that's sort of turned around now, where these healthy companies, these very healthy businesses that GE is in, are being dragged down by the fact that they're GE businesses and connected to other GE businesses.
So you mentioned the possibility of perhaps breaking up this just monolith giant company into smaller sections. Is that, how realistic is that?
Well, right. It's a good question. I mean, there's no question that GE is going to be selling off some businesses. They've talked about selling off $20 billion in assets, including, you know, the iconic light bulb business. There's talk of maybe selling off the transportation business, which is locomotives. That stuff is going to happen. The bigger question, though, is GE going to be basically dismembered? You know, are you going to end up with just no more GE? And that's a harder question. I think it's going to be very complicated to do that, partly because they're another one of GE's problems is these massive liabilities they have. Some of them are, you know, liabilities they still have from these financial businesses they sold years ago, but kept the debt so that people would agree to buy those businesses. The other thing is they have something on the order of a $30 billion pension shortfall. So how you divide all that stuff up between the different businesses is quite complicated. And I think that's going to be a disincentive to go all the way to that. But again, the fact that it's even being talked about, including by the new CEO of the company, is a sign of how far the company has fallen.
Right, truly. And you know, when you're seeing numbers attached to this, losing over 46% of its value, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of $120 billion with a B, that's not insignificant. And so, you know, it does seem like desperate times, desperate
year,
measure.
Right, exactly.
Right, over in 1 year.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at nearly 130-year-old company taking that big a hit, it does seem like some drastic moves are in order on some level. So do you think, in reporting this and looking at this story and this company so deeply, do you get the sense that they will emerge maybe a quieter, maybe more B2B brand, or will really just kind of try to distance, like spin off and distance each of those sub brands into kind of their own thing?
Right. Well, I think that, yeah, quieter is I think an interesting word to use. I think that's true. A lot of what they are now, I think one of the things people might not realize is that, you know, GE actually does not make home appliances anymore. They sold that business 2 years ago and licensed the brand to a Chinese manufacturer called Haier. So the big businesses they're in right now are jet engines, turbines, and medical equipment. So, and those are very good businesses, and I think they would like to find a way to stay in those three businesses at least. But yeah, I do think it's going to be the kind of aura around the company has already been dimmed, and I think you're going to see a less kind of ambitious, a less ambitious company.
Certainly. And do we have a sense of when we're going to start seeing moves from them, or is it really just going to be a wait and see sort of game?
Well, they're looking at selling off the stuff that they've talked about, that they've already announced that they're going to sell off already. I think we're not going to have an answer about whether the company is going to totally be broken up for a few months now. But when you're selling, you know, businesses like this, it, you know, even the small GE businesses are pretty big, and I think this will it'll take a little bit of time.
Right. It won't be, even the small business, as you say, will not be an insignificant sale. So I'm sure the buyer will be a high profile one. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Drake Bennett, staff writer at Bloomberg Businessweek. Appreciate you breaking all this down for us.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about Super Bowl ads. A lot of people thinking and talking and tweeting and all these things about those. And we're going to see them all tomorrow, but we're going to talk about them in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm cracking up with this song choice by esteemed producer Tom Hush. Of course, Super Bowl weekend is upon us. Super Bowl Sunday tomorrow. And of course, there's a lot of people going to be watching that game, eating the wings, doing the stuff. But also a lot of analysis and conversation around the Super Bowl ads that we really, there's so much that happens. There's a lot of money spent. Big companies really fight for these very, very important spots. They're coveted, highly coveted advertising spots. So who better to talk with us about that than EJ Schultz, the Chicago Bureau Chief of Advertising Age, who's been covering all the Super Bowl ads for this year very closely and joins us to talk about trends and which companies are making the biggest plays, all that good stuff. EJ, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be here.
So what can we expect to see? We've already kind of started seeing a little bit of it. Those ads get on YouTube a little early, little conversation, lots of speculation, a lot of screen grabs and stills that are making the rounds. But what are the big themes we're going to see tomorrow with our Super Bowl ads?
Right. Here we are about a little more than 24 hours away from the game, and I'd guess about 70 to 80% of the ads have already been released as the brands try to capitalize on the expensive ad buys by getting some attention on digital media. And to me, the biggest takeaway is sort of the caution that we're seeing by a lot of these brands. In the past years, we've seen a few ads try to take a political stance, even subtly. And I think that because some brands have gotten burned on that in the past, that we're seeing a lot of caution this year, even things with, you know, the Me Too movement going on in the background with women's empowerment issues sort of being at the forefront. I've yet to see any ads really kind of tackle that issue head on. We're seeing the usual array of sort of silliness and even the brands that are trying to inspire folks. They're doing it by being very careful not to touch any kind of hot button issue.
Yeah, I wondered about that because I started thinking about that even months ago, even because I thought, you know, it seemed like we, in response to some domestic violence narratives and stories that emerged from the NFL itself, we saw really quite moving and serious Super Bowl ads, you know, in response to that. So I wondered how everything happening with the Me Too movement was going to play. And that's kind of been my hunch, that we wouldn't see much of it, that rather than potentially do it wrong, that perhaps companies would just kind of skip it altogether.
That's what we're seeing. I mean, not want to rule out a brand or two doing it in the game that we just haven't seen yet. You know, some of the ads have not been released. So mm-hmm. That possibility still exists. But it's funny, one of my colleagues did a story actually counting sort of who the leads are in these ads so far, and that they're actually overwhelmingly male. And I think even in last year's game, there were 2.5 times more men in leading roles than women. This year, we're going to be seeing Danny DeVito starring for M&M's. Even Steven Tyler is making an appearance in a Kia ad. So, you know, it's interesting that more brands didn't choose to go with female lead in the current environment.
Right, right. I'm glad you mentioned that Danny DeVito one. I think that screen grab of him in this M&M shirt has been making the rounds more than any other thing. I think that's one of the most anticipated ads, perhaps.
Right. We're in terms of what's doing well so far, you know, the Amazon Alexa, I don't know if you've seen that one, that's getting a lot of buzz, where Alexa's voice is replaced by celebrities. I think it's pretty well done, actually, and it's getting a lot of attention. And the other ad that seems to be doing pretty well online is the Mountain Dew and Doritos kind of combination ad, mm-hmm. where they have Morgan Freeman and the star from Game of Thrones, Peter Dinklage, squaring off in a lip sync battle, which that one is, I think, racked up more online views than any other ad so far.
Right. And then, you know, are we seeing any maybe newcomers in that space? Because I feel like we always see a Budweiser ad. We always see a soft drink. We always see a car. It's kind of the same players of these huge, huge U.S. brands. Do we have newcomers in the space this year, or are we seeing the same?
So far, there's not a lot of new players. I think it's actually down from last year. I mean, even the brands that are new are big brands that are owned by big companies. Pringles, which is owned by Kellogg, they're doing, I think, their first ad this year. So far, we're not really seeing a ton of new players. It's sort of the same old
Same old cast of characters.
Yeah, yeah. Well, always going to be interesting. And then, as you note in the piece at adage.com, which I will be sure and tweet out after the show so everybody can take a look at all this for themselves, you mentioned in particular that we are seeing a little bit different take in the way that Cars are being played this year.
Right. There are the usual array of automotive brands, but in terms of the number of actual car markers in the game, it's a little bit down. But the two biggest companies doing advertisements in that space this year is Toyota and Fiat Chrysler, which has not shown their ads yet, but they said they're going to do 5 ads, and they're going to all be for either Jeep or Ram. Toyota is interesting. They have the big global Olympic sponsorship coming up. And, of course, the Olympics kicking off in a few days. They're taking advantage of the big Super Bowl audience to sort of plug their Olympic sponsorship. One of their ads is pretty well done. It's an emotional spot that sort of tracks the journey of a Paralympic skier. That one seems to be getting pretty well received.
Right. And then usually we see somebody has some big social media plans for during the game. We've seen some brands really do remarkable things in like during halftime or right after or throughout the game. Sometimes we've seen brands swoop in and take an unexpected moment and become, for better or worse, kind of have a moment with that. Do you get the sense of who that would be this year, or is that going to, you know, not necessarily any solid plans? It's going to be a wait and see.
I think the best social media tactics are literally responding in real time if something crazy happens during the game. I mean, the classic example that everyone cites is a few years ago when the lights went out at the Mercedes Superdome, and Oreo came in and had a nice little funny tweet, which for the time, that was, you know, three or four years ago, it was seen as sort of innovative. That kind of stuff happens all the time now with brands trying to take advantage of whatever's going on in the world on social media. So it's really harder to break through just because there's so many people trying.
Yeah. And so often missing the mark. You know, I think we saw right around the time so much anti-domestic violence campaign material was happening, we saw, I think it was DiGiorno's that tweeted something and really ended up with a PR crisis just within hours.
Yeah, one social media manager, one intern can have that power these days. If they put the wrong thing in a tweet, can really cause some damage. So I think a lot of brands have put some processes in place to try to be responsive and be quick on social media, but also be a little bit more responsible.
But not get eaten alive, right?
Exactly.
Definitely, because the internet does not forget. Indeed.
Right. I mean, one mistake is much worse than one hit.
Oh, gosh. I mean, really. Better to say nothing sometimes than to...
Exactly.
...than to take that big a risk and end up with a PR crisis for weeks and months and perhaps years. Indeed. All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. We are all going to be looking at those ads tomorrow, watching Super Bowl. Or if you're not with the Super Bowl, you're going to be watching Puppy Bowl or something. So thank you so much for being with us, EJ Schultz, Chicago Bureau Chief of Advertising Age.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a break, and we're going to chat a little bit with the next show and see what they have coming up, and then get you to news. All that coming up here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN, that does it for us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It is time to turn things over to our good friend Scott Catoon for the Startup Showcase. What's happening today?
We've got a cool show. We've got another Startup Showcase, so we're going to have Every Table, which is... I think it's pretty good. It's basically fast food, but with fresh food, healthy food.
Okay, I'm
so
on board with
kind of
that.
A cool thing. They're out of Los Angeles. They're going to call in. People have an opportunity to invest in them if they want to.
What are they called again?
It's called Every Table.
Every Table, okay.
So like the commercial they have is amazing. It's a French fry box, but it's filled with pickles, which I had pickles for dinner last night. So,
great.
Hey, you know, what the heck? That'll be cool. We're going to talk to Get Snap Clips, is another company that's been on WGN with Steve Bertrand, kind of catch up with them and see where they're going. And then we're going to talk about our Startup Showcase. So it should be kind of a fun, quick little show today.
Excellent. All right. Well, I'll leave you to it.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, this show, sorry, do you have that read piece? I don't have the...
I don't, but I kind of know it. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Radio. And what does it say after that? WGNradio.com?
WGNradio.com.
If
you're an Amazon... Just say play WGN Radio.
There you go.
We're going off script, friends. All right. It is seconds away from
being...
We got
the important.